We're ready to go with our second session, and having finished now the what is philosophy, a theory of reality, a theory of knowledge mainly, but there are a few leftover things that are usually kept in the philosophy curriculum besides the theory of reality, besides ontology and epistemology, and those have mostly because these things arose with it historically, and have just never changed much. See if I can tell you what I mean. Usually, the study of ethics is kept in a philosophy curriculum, and the study of logic, because those two fields were worked up by philosophers, and they just never left. They could easily be departments of their own. The way physics has branched off, and biology has branched off, and mathematics has branched off, and astronomy, they were all originally done by people who were called philosophers, but they become their own separate disciplines. And ethics and logic have hung around; they're still parts of philosophy. And then another thing that that happens with the philosophy is that there are the philosophy of courses, where you fill out in the blank, and we do philosophy of religion, philosophy of ethics, philosophy of mathematics, philosophy of biology, philosophy of science, and so on. Those courses all are philosophical because what happens is that we study views that begin with the theory of reality and knowledge, and then proceed to deal with that specific science. So if it's philosophy of physics, say, then we would deal with theory of issues and theory of reality and knowledge and come to physical theories and see how they differ among physicists depending on which theory of reality or knowledge they assume in their work. Because I think that's the important point here. The important point is that it's not possible to avoid philosophical assumptions. That whatever position you take within a specific study, whether that's anything from math to ethics, that taking any position on the issues commits you to some position in philosophy of reality and knowledge. So we think it's best to be clear about where you are in the philosophy of knowledge, the theory of knowledge, the theory of reality, in order to be crystal clear about what you're doing within a specific area that you're applying it to. Now, there's one more issue that's come up, and that is that many people have wondered which is basic to the other. Is it the theory of reality, is basic to epistemology, or you have to do epistemology to do theory of reality? So which would it be? And as a matter of fact, the position that I'm taking here in this course, and then that we take, this Christian curriculum that this is part of, is that neither one of them generates the other, but that both are in fact generated by religious belief. That they both rest on a foundation of a conviction of religious belief. And so before we go on, I want to stop and ask what is a religious belief and clarify the nature of religion. And then we can go back and look at the religious convictions of the different thinkers in relation to their theory of reality and their theory of knowledge. It seems odd to ask, then, what is religious belief? People are all sure that they know examples of it, but having to give an abstract definition of it's a different task. And it seems to be a much more difficult one. All sorts of things have been regarded as religious, and I can still remember first time I was assigned to teach comparative religion, this is back in the Dark Ages when I first started, I decided I'd check up on how the field was defined. So I started to consult a bunch of books on comparative religion. You know, read the introduction. What's the book about? It's about comparing different religions. How do you know what a religion is? Well, the older books that I found had definitions that seemed wrong to me. And as I got to books that came nearer our own time, they pointed out why these definitions didn't work. And then went through an era in which different thinkers would propose that it's either or any of these. It's definition A or B or C or D, and in order to try to get cover the whole ground. And that seemed to me to be a mishmash. And sure enough, as I kept on reading, I got to more recent books yet. People were pointing that out. This didn't work either. And then we went through a time when the big thing was to say it can't be defined. It can't be defined at all. It's just, I guess, something like the Supreme Court said about pornography. We can't define it, but we know it when we see it. But that won't do. If you're going to have a comparative religion book, you want to compare religions. How do you know they're all religions you're comparing if you don't have any standard at all for saying what's a religion or not? And I began to think about that problem. It seemed to me that I had seen a lot of stuff about this, and it was in some of the ancient thinkers that I had read, some of the very people that we're going to be talking about here as the beginnings of philosophy. And they worried about this too. Here's what one of them had to say. This is a man named Anaximander. This is about 600 BC. And he says, the divine is that from which everything takes rise and returns. It's whatever has no beginning and no end. As the source of everything else. I said to myself, what's the matter with that? The divine is the source of everything else. Anaximander goes on. It is the origin of all things, while itself it has no origin. Now, that seems to me hits the nail right on the head. These ancient thinkers had it right. Religious belief has a number of senses, but the core sense is that it's a belief in something or other as divine. And what is meant by divine? That which is the origin of everything else and does not itself have an origin. There are several ways to put this. You could put it that divine is what is self-existent. Logically, the cleanest way to put it is that divine is unconditionally non-dependent, does not depend on anything in any way. It's whatever reality just is. And everything else depends on it. It depends on nothing. I hear some of you saying, so how do you know there is such a thing? Good question. I think it's indubitable that something is self-existent. Here's why. Let's call this the sum total of reality. This represents everything whatever that exists, that ever did, never will. It's the sum total of all that's real. Now, my contention here is this. This sum total either in part or in whole, has to be self-existent because there's nothing else for it to depend on. There is nothing else. Now, a lot of thinkers have spent a lot of time struggling with this issue, and they've constructed elaborate modal logical proofs that there has to be something that couldn't fail to exist, and they've gone through all kinds of mental gymnastics to come to this conclusion. But I think it's that simple. If you consider the sum total of reality, it's all that there is, then it has to be self-existent. Either the whole is self-existent while none of the parts are, or some part of it is self-existent and the rest depends on that part or parts, because there is nothing else. If there's nothing else, there's nothing else it could depend on. It's as simple as that. I'm going to call that the divine reality. And I'm not assuming any other characteristics to the divine than self-existence. Something is self-existent. What is it? Look at this again. There are three religions that say it's the whole of reality. Nothing in the universe, no thing, is self-existent. No state of affairs, no law, nothing within the universe is self-existent. It's the whole of reality that is. And that wholeness is a divine reality that exists in addition to this, to the universe. And the three religions that hold that view are Hinduism, Buddhism, and Taoism. It's the wholeness. It's the beingness that's in everything that is the independent reality. In Hinduism, that's called Brahmanatman. It has several different names in Buddhism, suchness, dharmakaya, the beingness that is in every single individual being. It's what all the beings in the world are made of, but they all come into being and pass away. The beingness, the Brahmanatman, remains. It is totally non-dependent and totally unknowable. That's the core divinity belief of those three religions. There are, however, other religions, that three others that hold, no, it's not the wholeness, it's one part. It's one part of reality, the part we call God, and all the rest depends on that part. That the three religions that hold that are Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. God is the one reality upon which everything else depends, while God depends on nothing. In each case, the idea is to identify the self-existent reality. And in each case, that's done. Right? Because in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, God is outside, exists outside the whole realm of creation, all the universe in which is our home, which the universe we inhabit, that God must be known because he reveals himself. God has to take the initiative and create in the world knowledge of himself, reveal himself, make himself known, and that's how you know God. On the other three religions, Hinduism, Buddhism, and later Taoism, the way to know God is by the meditations and so on through which you your mind is able to ascend to the very being that's in yourself and everything else, and you come to experience it, though you can't describe it. And I think that is the right way to break down the comparative religion chart. So the first thing religious belief is about what is divine. That's the core belief. And then there are other secondary senses of religious belief that all relate to that. You have the core, the belief in something or other as divine, whatever, which whichever reality you pick for that. And then there's the specific nature of the divine, the specific idea, including that there can't be one, that there's no description whatsoever. That's one possible way to say what specifically is divine, nothing we can describe. Another being, a secondary sense of religion, is that it has to do with how the non-divine depends upon the divine. And in Hinduism, Buddhism, and later Taoism, it is that the divine generates the non-divine out of itself. It itself is the stuff of which all the non-divine things are made, come into being, pass away, reabsorbed, and so on. In Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, God calls into being the existence of the world, of creatures that are dependent upon him and are never become independent of him. They depend upon God in every respect, at all times, always. So that's how it answers the question, what's the relation between the non-divine and the divine? There's yet another sense of religious belief, and that's how do humans come to stand in right relation to the divine? And that's what we commonly call religion. That's what where all the beliefs and the doctrines, the practices, the holy days, the rituals and sacraments all grow up around that. How do we know how to stand in proper relation to the divine? So to sum up, here's what we have as a definition for religious belief. The core of it is divinity. And this is the reality completely non-dependent reality, whatever that is. And then there is a sense of the specific idea of what that reality is, even if the specific idea is that you can't have any specific idea. That's what Hinduism and Buddhism would say. And then there is how does the non-divine depend on the divine? In Hinduism, Buddhism, and later Taoism, it's that the divine depends by being made out of the divine. The non-divine is generated out of the divine being itself. And then finally, how do humans acquire the right relation to the divine reality? So here's the number one, the idea of divinity. Then there is the specific idea, and the idea of how the non-divine depends on the divine, and how do people come to stand in right relation to the divine. And this, I think, works very well. There is no religion it leaves out. There's nothing that it turns into a religion that isn't really one. and it's what we found was recognized by Anaximander, 600 BC. He got it right from the beginning. The divine is what has no origin, but is the origin of everything else. Different people have put any number of things into that slot. I mentioned to you in the last lecture that the Pythagoreans thought that the world that we live in is made out of numbers. And their reason for that was that they believed that numbers were divine. You ready for that? Numbers are divine. Numbers are have no origin. They never had a beginning. They'll never have an end. They depend on nothing whatsoever. And all the numbers and their ratios, their relationships between numbers, all give us eternal truths of mathematics that can't fail to be true and can't fail to exist. Now, you're going to think this is really strange, but the Pythagoreans not only did mathematics, they worshipped numbers. Here, I thought you would be interested. Here is their prayer to the number 10. Bless us, divine number, thou that generates gods and men. For number begins with a profound, the pure unity. That's the number one. Until it comes to the holy four. Then it begets the mother of the all-encompassing, all-founding, all-bounding, the firstborn, never swerving, never tiring, holy ten. The key holder of all things. Actually prayed to the numbers. So they not only thought that numbers were non-physical objects, they thought they were partly personal, or it wouldn't make any point to pray to them. Of course, there have been a lot of other things regarded as divine. In our own day and time, there are people who are materialists who say there is no God, God doesn't exist, all the religions are bunk. The world's just physical, and that's it. But if you ask where the physical world came from, what you usually get is some story about why it's always been around, and that it doesn't depend on anything else. And anything that might exist that isn't physical depends on what's physical. And that makes the purely physical divine. That's their divinity. It's not that they have no religion, they just have a different one. A Jew or a Christian says it's God who's divine. The materialist says it's matter and energy, or the smallest quantum particles, or quantum fluctuations, or whatever suits your fancy. You pick something. There's something that's purely physical, and that's the divine reality. So I want to point out a number of consequences that come from this definition. The first is it's virtually impossible to avoid some commitment to something as divine. It's not a question of whether to have such a belief. It's because it appears to be impossible to avoid. Whatever theory of reality you cook up assumes something is the divine reality. Whatever theory you cook up in a science assumes a theory of reality. So in two steps, every scientific theory or theory in a specific discipline again, such as mathematics or physics or biology, sociology, and so on, they assume a theory of reality. And theory of reality assumes that something is in the divinity slot. Something is what it is that just is and isn't dependent on anything, while everything else is dependent on it or them. It's a whole realm of things. It's the unconditionally self-existent producer of everything else. Well, I started to tell you that I was looking for the definition of religion because I was assigned to teach comparative religion. And eventually I got it to the point where I was going around to different libraries and taking out all their books on philosophy on comparative religion, sticking them in the trunk, taking them home and surveying all of them one after another, dozens and dozens of them, to see how people were defining it. And I found that trend, that they rejected the older definitions, they tried to disjoin them, then they tried saying, can't be defined at all. Well, I found that didn't work either. And in fact, what I did find then was that the old definition that Anaximander had come up with, and that had been held by Plato and Aristotle, and held by virtually every medieval author, was still known to a great many authors. It wasn't acknowledged routinely in the comparative religion books, and in religious studies I had never heard it even mentioned. It was never mentioned in philosophy of religion either. But I found a number of people who held it and who knew about it, and I'm just going to mention them because it's quite a distinguished list. I want you to hear the people that persisted in holding this old definition. Besides Plato and Aristotle, John Calvin, C.S. Lewis, William James, Paul Tillich, Karl Barth, Norman Kemp Smith, Hans Kuhn, Mircea Eliade, the great comparative religion scholar, Will Herberg, Robert Neville, Werner Jaeger, Hermann Doiver, David Bentley Hart. It's quite a wide spectrum of scholars from all different points of view themselves, that they all see that this is what's going on in religion, and they all endorse that definition of religious belief. Another criticism that sometimes raised to me, and you're too polite to do this, and you can't anyway because I can't hear what you're saying, but I know some people always say, well, how wide can your reading be? I mean, granted, if even you're an old guy and you spent a long time now reading about this stuff, but you haven't read everything, how do you know that all religious beliefs fit this? Well, I haven't read everything, no. My reading is wider than some and not as wide as others, but when you take that list and you add all the reading of all those people, it really is impressive. They know of no exception, and I don't either. This is the definition that really seems to work, and it's based on very, very wide reading indeed. Well, we needed to get that clear because we have to be clear about what religious belief is. Remember, my thesis here is that theories that are in specific disciplines, again, like that list that I had that I couldn't finish because I didn't have enough room. It goes mathematics, physics, biology, psychology, logic, linguistics, sociology, economics, aesthetics, ethics, so on and so on. All the different disciplines. Whatever theory we cook up in there to explain what's going on assumes some view of reality and some view of knowledge. I mean knowledge and reality in the abstract. Knowledge as in an ontology. I mean an epistemology. Reality as in an ontology. And that, in turn, ontology or epistemology, assumes something to be the divine reality. That's the view that I'm going to take and that I'm going to make out and argue for. And that's why it's important to get these definitions straight and do so early on. Let's consider for a moment what some of the objections are to this definition. One objection is that we should really just define religion as belief in a supreme being. In fact, the Supreme Court of the United States has several times held that while our laws don't assume that somebody has to have a religious belief, and they don't assume any particular one, they do assume that there's a supreme being. Well, that's a lot more biased than they think it is. In the first place, a lot of religions don't believe in a supreme being. Hinduism is one again. I've already mentioned that instead of having a being that is supreme or creator, Hinduism holds that there is being itself. The beingness that is in everything is called Brahmanatman. It is not an individual being. It is not a person. You do not pray to it. But it is what generates everything in reality, of the reality we experience, and it's all that reality that we experience is made of that. Brahmanatman is the very stuff of which everything is made, including ourselves. So there's something that's divine by our definition, but is not a supreme being. Buddhism, likewise, does not believe in a supreme being, not even the Buddha. In Theravada Buddhism, there is no one to pray to. you engage in meditation in order to become closer and closer to the divine beingness, but it's not an individual whom you can please or displease. In addition, in Buddhism, there is a drive to get yourself to the point where you desire nothing. The cessation of all desire is the peak spiritual experience. So there isn't anything that is supreme to you. There's nothing that's of greatest value. You shut all that down because all the reality that surrounds us is illusory and temporary and doesn't show its real character. And you long only to be reabsorbed into the divine being, and even that is something for which you don't thirst and yearn and strive, but something you simply let happen. There are also many other religions in which there's no supreme being. There are polytheisms in which there's a whole panoply of gods and goddesses, but no one of which is supreme over all the others. What's worse for this definition is that in some of the polytheisms, there are gods and goddesses that are hated. There are gods and goddesses that are evil, that do you harm, that wish you ill, and with whom you resist. You not only don't regard them as supreme, you just regard them as disgusting. So those religions don't fit this as a definition at all. Another proposed definition is it's whatever we value most, our supreme value. I've already told you, you now already know that there are objections. There are religions that don't hold that at all. There are religions that hold there are gods and goddesses they hate, or that are evil, or that they object to. Religion doesn't have to do with what you value most. In fact, not even Christianity does that. God, for a Christian, is not just a value. We don't simply value God. The command says we're to love God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength. That goes beyond just valuing God. Value is too weak a word there. Another objection is that there are lots of gods and goddesses in different religions who are not the self-existent creators of everything else. So how can that be the right definition for religious belief? And the answer is that while that's true, it's irrelevant. Let me see if I can make it clearer for you. There can be a divine reality. Let's do it this way. And then it can be embodied in different gods and goddesses. And collect in different spots. In other words, the divine reality in some religions is thought to be very fluid. It flows through everything. It collects in certain places so that some spots on earth are loaded with divinity. And there are specific beings called gods and goddesses that have more divine power than humans do. Humans also have divinity in them, though. If one man can throw a spear further than anybody else and run faster, it's because there's more divinity in him. So what is divine per se is the divine force that collects in individuals and makes them gods, or collects at certain spots and makes those spots holy or numinous, and so on. That's, in other words, they're not using the word God the same way that a Jew, Christian, or Muslim would. For a Jew or Christian or Muslim, God is the name for the divine reality, and that's the only reality that's divine, is God. in many pagan polytheistic religions, there are many gods and goddesses because there's a divine power that collects in them in different degrees and collects at different spots and in different people. And so you deal with divinity generally, but usually as embodied in one or another god. Those gods are not self-existent and are not the creators of everything other than themselves. In those religions, it's the divine reality itself that does all those things. It generates everything else, including the other gods and goddesses. Well, there's yet another objection, and it goes like this. Look, you're trying to sell me this definition that says that something is self-existent, generates everything else. That's what religions call divine. And they're trying to identify that. So they all agree that the divine is that reality. They just don't agree on which reality it is. Right? And my answer is yes, that's right. That's what I'm trying to say. Okay, but then a lot of theories regard something as self-existent, as the ultimate reality on which everything depends. So that can't be right. These theories are often held by people who are opposed to religion, that debunk religion. They don't want a religion. They don't hold anything by faith. They don't practice any religion. How can you tell me that's the right definition of religious belief when there are a lot, it's embodied in a lot of theories? I agree it is. And those theories are holding a religious belief, whether their authors want that to be a religious belief or not. It's well known that people propose theories without realizing all that the theory implies, all that it entails or includes, and that often it ends up entailing some other belief that the author of the theory wouldn't like to think is true. If a theoretical materialist, somebody who's against, thinks he's against all religions, debunks them all, does not believe in any gods or goddesses, says nothing is divine, but then holds that there's purely physical matter that's self-existent and generates everything else, then he's got a divinity belief. It's not so easy to get rid of. See, a fellow graduate student said to me one time, show me any belief that's religious in any sense that I hold, and I'll give it up on the spot. Sounds brave and courageous, but he couldn't do it. He's a materialist. If it's matter and energy that's divine, you've got a divinity belief. That is, if it's matter and energy, purely physical matter, that has independent reality and generates anything else that there may be, then you've got a divinity. It doesn't have to be something you worship. Worship is not common to all religions. Brahmin Hinduism has no worship. Theravada Buddhism has no worship. In Shinto religion, you honor your ancestors, but you are not worshiping. Worship makes sense if and only if you think of the divine as personal. So Jews, Christians, and Muslims who think of God as personal engage in worship. And so do polytheists who may have many gods and goddesses, but think of them as persons to whom they can relate. In ancient Korean folk religion, they thought of the gods and goddesses as persons. And they thought of them as persons that they could influence to get what they want or needed. There was a practice in the ancient native Korean religion of putting the image of your god in a place of honor in the house and decorating it with flowers and burning incense and asking for favor. If they didn't get the favor, they took whips and beat the statue because they wanted something. So there's not only worship, there might be coercion involved too. But that's thinking of the divine as personal. finally, there's an objection that goes, well, what has all of this then to do with faith? When somebody takes the divine to be, say, matter and energy, just the purely physical matter of the world, it seems to me they are not exercising faith the way a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist might be said to exercise faith. How does that play? What role does it play? How does it come in here? And I think that the proper answer to this is that faith is grossly misunderstood as it operates in a religious context. People mean very many different things by faith. But the original writings, the official scriptures of the different religions, when examined, will show you that there is not a religion on this planet that ever used the word faith to mean blind trust, trust for no reason whatsoever. There isn't a religion on the planet that ever asked anybody to believe it against evidence or without evidence or with no reason. They all say that there's a reason, but that the reason is the intuitive grasp of its truth. They ask anyone to believe only because he or she sees it to be true for himself or herself. It has nothing to do with blind trust. It has nothing to do with going against evidence or not having any. The evidence is its apparent truth. And the word for that in philosophy is self-evident. When you just see something is right, you're asked, well, does one and one make two? Yes. How do you know? It just looks right, and I can't think of any reason why it could be wrong. That means it's something that's self-evident to you. It's experienced as prima facie true. And that's the way the scriptures of these religions speak of seeing the truth of them. And they all say the same thing. You must see it as true for yourself to be a believer, and that's what you should aspire to. You read, you engage in the practices in order to come to see it as true for yourself so that it becomes self-evident to you. So faith has nothing to do with blind trust. And I would say that if that's so, if this is the right way to see faith, faith is another name for seeing religious truth to be self-evident, then the pure materialist who takes pure matter and energy as the divine reality that generates everything is also exercising a faith. It's not a faith that results in worship. I already covered that. But worship isn't practiced by all religions anyway. It's not a characteristic of them all. The pure materialist is taking on faith that is seeing as self-evident, that it's the physical reality that's self-existent and generates everything else, and doesn't thereby engage in hymns to force fields and prayer to quarks and stuff that there's no worship involved. But there is faith in the religious sense of that term, which is an important sense to grasp. So, what else? Well, I didn't cover the objection that says religious faith, religious belief simply can't be defined at all. There are several prominent thinkers in the latter part of the 20th century who held this, and I'm going to quote one of them. One of them says, "Science isn't interested in essential definitions. A modern physicist can't define matter, but he can handle it, and he can do so because his predecessors eventually learned that essential definitions don't matter. He understands the behavior of matter, not because he knows what it essentially is, but because he has learned how it operates and how it changes." And then he goes on to say, "Whatever really exists in the world can't be defined, and whatever can be defined doesn't exist." (Laughter) What a mess. First of all, that author has confused a couple of different issues. He's right that scientists don't have an essential definition for everything they deal with, but at key points they must have essential definitions for a great deal that they deal with, or the whole thing goes down the tube. An electron is essentially a negatively charged particle. Water is essentially H2O. There are all kinds of essential definitions that are absolutely believed by science and are the key linchpins for holding together what we can't define essentially. So the fact that science doesn't always have them is irrelevant. What he's trying to suggest is science never has essential definitions, and if science can get along without them, religion can. But he's wrong about science, and he's wrong that religion doesn't have them. I just gave it to you. The essential definition is that a belief is religious if and only if it is a belief in something as divine, where divine means has unconditionally non-dependent reality and everything else depends on it, or it's a specific idea of the being that has that ultimate reality, or it is a belief about how the non-defined depends upon the divine, or it's a belief about how humans come to stand in right relation to the divine. That's an essential definition. Then this author adds, whatever exists really exists in the world can't be defined, and whatever can be defined doesn't exist. And here he's confused two other issues. It's true that you can't get a complete definition of anything that exists in the world. If I want to get a definition of, say, my briefcase, I can't define it by mentioning every characteristic it has, because it has an indefinitely large number of characteristics, and I don't need to know them all in order to recognize my briefcase sitting across the room or pick it out from a bunch of other briefcases. I just need to have enough characteristics in my concept of the briefcase that lets me distinguish it from other briefcases. Right. So there's no complete definition of any concrete individual thing. That's right. But we don't need that. Then he says, not only can nothing be, he leaves out completely defined, but whatever can be completely defined doesn't exist. And there what he means is that we can completely define a class of objects. We can give a definition that's short and includes everything something needs in order to be a briefcase. And he's saying, but the class doesn't exist. There are only really briefcases. And what you're defining is the class briefcase. And so whatever can be defined doesn't exist. It's a total confusion. Things don't have to be defined completely to be defined well enough to pick them out, to recognize what type of thing they are, and to be able to deal with them in concepts. We don't have to have complete definitions. It's not complete or nothing. It's we have partial, as we have partial understanding and partial knowledge. And that's what we attempt to expand by pursuing all the different sciences and philosophy. That's how we hope to come to some reasonable conclusion about this. So, in our next session, what I want to cover are the basic types of religious belief. Look at that a little more closely. We'll type them by how they regard the non-divine as depending on the divine. We'll go over the definition again. We'll go over the types. And then we'll be done with our separate section on religious belief. And we'll go back and begin to look at the early philosophical theories of reality, ontologies, you know that term now, and we'll see how they depended on religious beliefs of the thinkers. So I commended to you again the reading, and I remind you to do the reading, see the lectures, do the reading again. That's the way to proceed. Okay, till next time.